From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk about the winter as we celebrate the season with some cold weather idioms. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each and every week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hello, Kathy, there at your home in Armia. Ross, you are there, sipping tea or coffee. Lovely, at your home in Toronto. Must be a chilly morning there, Ross.
No, actually, it's not really that bad. It's about 32, 33 degrees or something like that. Actually, it's sort of weird because it was really cold a couple days ago, and today we feel positively balmy.
Okay, wait a minute,
go outside
of
bathing
suits. It's 32 Fahrenheit, and you're saying it's warm?
That's what we feel here.
It's 50 Fahrenheit here, and I've spent the entire day bemoaning the incredible chill.
No, we went to see some friends yesterday. It was snowing gently, and we were going, this really isn't that bad. I like snow, though, so whatever.
We had a extremely cold month or so here in the Midwest, and then yesterday it got up to 70 degrees, so we don't even know what we're doing. But it is winter. It's definitely winter somehow, somewhere. And so today we're going to talk about some idioms of the winter. We talked about words of the summer last summer. It's always nice to check in with the seasons and acknowledge that they still exist while they do, I guess.
Kind of. But first, this came in today, and we wanted to quickly talk about it because both of us found it very funny. Kimba in Winnipeg, Canada, sent us this. She said, this was in a thing I got on my email. She sent a screenshot. Apparently, it was in a thread she was reading. Someone wrote, an American clearly, I want to know why Z is Z in Canada. Mm-hmm. I thought y'all spoke English. So she said, I like this. She said, I immediately thought of you three. What I wanted to reply was, well, why do people from the United States say it wrong?
Actually, I mean, we're not prescriptivist here, but Z is by far, I mean, Canada, the UK, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, India, all English-speaking countries basically say Z, not Z. So I would say, as Kathy just did, it's the opposite in terms of who's saying what.
Well, Ross, here in Spain, Z is Zeta, as in the Greek, which is where Z came from. So, I mean, it's as clearly, the Z is very not normal.
Yeah, I think it's Noah Webster who got the Americans saying Z, not Z. And it did come from a certain dialect in English, but it didn't really catch on. Webster basically in the States codified it. Actually, on a different note, before we go into that, I want to ask you guys one other thing, particularly Kathy, because I think you know slang more. Did we talk about slay being used?
We may have briefly at one point. I remember talking about drag ball culture and talking about, you know, when you slay. It's not just like a stand-up comic doing really well and killing, you know. Slay has a very specific meaning in like drag culture too.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I was talking to someone who's far removed from that. She was an 11-year-old girl. And we're talking about slang that they use in school. And she was saying slay as in like a noun. That's slay.
Oh, it is slay. Interesting. Well,
Heard that.
No, I've never heard that at all. It doesn't surprise me that that would happen. I mean, just like that's cringe, you know? And I mean, like with, you know, drag culture is very popular right now, especially with like RuPaul's Drag Race. And so the term slay is going to be out there in a lot of places. And as it filters down and as it gets, you know, played with by younger people, it's going to turn into something like a noun. That's interesting.
It is. Cause no, I was not aware. I have heard like you go, so if somebody did something good, you go, yeah, slay. Mm-hmm. Like, whoa, you were really slay.
Yeah. She also used it that way. She also used it that way. And then the other one was really interesting because her parents said cringe. And she rolled her eyes like, oh my God, 35-year-old bags, you know, what do they know?
Saying something is cringe is now cringe.
Oh gosh. She's like, I mean, you could, she was trying to be polite, but you could just see her just revulsion at her parents being so
magnificent.
Out of it.
I love it.
Should we move on?
Yes, let's move on.
We're moving on to words in the news.
We should have like a little, like those old things, like the music going on.
Words.
You know?
Yeah.
No.
In the news. Okay, we wanted to talk about rescission, which was, we couldn't avoid it a few weeks ago, right? I mean, rescission.
The White House press secretary, Trump announced something, and the White House press secretary, basically everyone got upset about the funding freeze, and she said, she clarified this whole argument.
Well,
said,
that word's doing a lot of work there. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But she said, this is not a rescission of the federal funding freeze. It is simply a rescission of the OMB memo. The word rescission is a relatively rare word in current English usage. But let's first get to what Kathy just showed you, Fletcher, in terms of spelling of the word. Then we'll get to the definitions, etc.
Okay, yeah, Kathy sent me three spellings, or three possible spellings, I suppose, of rescission. R-E-S-C-I-S-S-I-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
R-E-C-I-S-S-I-O-N. So we took out the S, instead of R-E-S, just R-E-C. And then the third is R-E-C-I-S-I-O-N. So only one S in the ision part. And so are you asking me which is correct or which is most common?
Well, let's do both.
If I were going to write it for some reason and you know, it just out of my head, I decided I was going to write rescission, I would probably write it R-E-C-I-S-S-I-O-N.
Hmm.
Interesting.
That doesn't mean I have any idea what I'm doing.
You do know what it means, don't you? Or, I mean, it's not surprising if you didn't, but...
To rescind something?
Yeah. Well,
yes.
To cancel,
okay,
to repeal.
Fletcher. Yeah. Can you spell rescind?
Oh. Yeah, okay. Rescind is R-E-S-C, isn't it? R-E-S-C-I-N-D.
Yes.
Didn't think about that while I was looking at these.
Yeah, and generally speaking, the first, R-E-S, R-E-S-C-I-S-S-I-O-N, is the normal spelling. However, Kathy will now throw us an interesting factoid.
Well, there were two. I have two factoids. The second spelling the third, R-E-C-I-S-I-O-N, is also often found.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Interesting.
That's like considered a alternate spelling.
Okay.
The other one, R-E-C-I-S-S-I-O-N, is not in dictionaries. However... In the Legal Information Institute, they spell it with that.
Oh, wow.
So it's really confusing. The key thing with the word, though, really, I think, is it tends to be quite rare. And here's the really weird thing. Kathy and I were looking at Google Ngram, which is admittedly sort of unscientific because it does records words as in books, and you're not sure that's the only way. But we found two brief high peaks of the word. Used 1933 and 1977, four or five times more frequently used in books in those 2 years than any time else. And we were wondering why. We thought, like, we looked up rescission and, like, you know, events in the news or whatever. And, you know, the 33 was the Depression, and there was something occurring then. And then 1977, I forgot what, there was some rescinding funds for international security clearance. So maybe that was it. I don't know.
Hmm.
But it's a rare enough word that autocorrect constantly, when I was writing it in and Kathy was writing it in, it would constantly, you know, basically correct it to recession.
Oh, wow.
Which is a different word completely. The origins of the word are completely different, too. The re part is the same in Latin, but the recession means going backwards, from sedo going back. And,
it's funny because I thought it would have something to do with scissors because I saw the S-C-I-S-S.
Brilliant, Kathy. You're right. Rescission does have something to do with scissors. It does.
Oh. I didn't look up the etymology. So
well, it's rescindere, which is to cut off.
Oh, wow.
Of course.
But recession is to go, recedere is to go backwards, just to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both different origin words, but, and they mean completely different things, but autocorrect in some ways quite justifiably basically says, no one ever says rescission. You must mean recession. So, I'm going to give Kathy the cold shoulder after saying things like that.
Ooh, Ross.
Well, it is winter. I suppose now is the time to jump into those winter idioms. The cold shoulder. I would not give warm shoulder. Here is my
obviously, we're stretching things with cold. we're doing basically. I mean, you can give someone the cold shoulder in, you know, in March and August too. You're allowed to.
And it's not as cold, Ross. Okay. Okay. So, Fletcher, quiz time. Cold shoulder. Where do we think it came from? So we have three choices for you. One, a custom back in Shakespearean times was to serve unwelcome guests the cold shoulder of mutton, i.e. it had been on the table for a while, it wasn't the tastiest, so it's like, get out. We don't really want you here, okay? Number two, was it a mistranslation from a Bible verse that was first done by Sir Walter Scott? Number three, is it from you're turning your shoulder away from someone, you're turning your back on them, and thus exposing it to the wind, i.e. the cold?
So I've actually heard that Shakespearean one before about the cold shoulder of mutton. That sounds like complete bunk to me. I think it's as simple as just having your shoulder, like actual shoulder, turned to the wind, the cold shoulder.
You were right and wrong.
Oh. So is it really the cold piece of meat?
No, okay. You were right that that's wrong.
It's a Bible mistranslation. Well, there's so many of those, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's for the book of Nehemiah, and it's turning your shoulder to people. Incidentally, we have here, like, I think it was from, I don't know where it's from, but we have this expression as a mistranslation of the Latin phrase "deterrent numerum recedit," and the Latin phrase they have means stubbornly they turn their backs on you, which is not the Latin phrase meaning at all. Oh. And then they say it comes from the Septuagint Bible's Greek equivalent, idoken noton apathunata, which means is the equivalent. And then they have a definition there that's also wrong. Basically, what it really, I mean, I'm just, this is like minor, who cares? But you have to sort of be careful when you look this stuff up, because this is in several places and it's not correct. The Latin phrase really means like giving a receding shoulder to someone, and which, I mean, it does give you that idea. And the Greek phrase is sort of a similar meaning in that sense. So I was just sort of curious about how people do stuff. It's not, you know, you got to watch out here.
But Sir Walter Scott said, shooing all the cold shoulder. That's my accent there. So Ross, that's the accent that he said it in. My question for you then is, how did old Sir Walter Scott get it?
I don't know. That's what I was really wondering about, because there's nothing in the Greek or the Latin about cold, except the fact that, like, you know, you're basically, the idea is there. You're turning your back. You're not, in the Greek, you're not persuaded by the back turning, or what you're, by turning your back, you're showing you're not persuaded. But the cold part, I didn't really get. I'm really sort of wondering if our definition is Scott.
Which
used
the one that Fletcher picked, turning your shoulder to someone, exposing it to the wind.
I know, it's weird. I don't know. I mean, everything says what we said. Everything says it's from the mistranslation from the book of Nehemiah.
I think it's wrong. I think that Sir Walter Scott was thinking like you and me, Ross.
Or maybe he looked at the Greek and said, they didn't really put it that well. I don't think he did.
I don't think he looked at the Greek. I do. I'm sorry.
I defer to your knowledge of Sir Walter Scott and what he was thinking. Okay, Fletcher, we're going to move on to another. We're kind of pushing things here with winter related, but the snowball effect.
Oh,
what does that mean?
No, that makes sense. That's the snowball effect. A small snowball is rolling down a mountain with a bunch of snow on it, and it keeps collecting more snow and getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And it snowballs until it's huge and it destroys everything. I took some liberties with that, but basically, you know, it keeps getting bigger.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you here, we were going to do a quiz, but we're going to ask you specific questions on this now. First of all, before snowball effect, there was another snowball effect type word that was used.
Ross, you're reaching.
Well, it's slippery outside, all the snow, whatever.
So, am I looking to replace all of snowball effect or just the word effect?
You can keep snowball. But this is sort of interesting because this shows how idioms kind of develop, actually. This other word wasn't quite as good, so it ended up being chucked down.
Really not nearly as good.
Yeah. Let's see. The snowball identity, the snowball supremacy, the snowball ultimatum.
Ross, let's just tell him. First, we have in 1897, an anonymous snowball contribution was started.
Snowball contribution?
Look, they did have snowball in quotes, at least. So.
And then I think shortly after that, there was the snowball system. This scheme of old age pensions depends on the snowball system.
Wow.
Offering magnificent terms to any assurer who gets them 10 other assurers, and so
that's
on.
That's like a rolling Ponzi snowball. Scheme. That's a pyramid scheme, actually. The snowball system is Ponzi.
The snowball system is a Ponzi scheme, but Ponzi hadn't been born yet, though, so I guess they...
So we don't have snowball effect until 1941.
But the idea was there.
Yeah, but the more you're saying things like snowball contribution and snowball system, I don't think snowball effect is that great either now that we're saying all this. That word effect, it seems a little too, I don't know, scientific to me.
You know something, Fletcher? I actually was thinking the same thing as we were talking. Because, you know, we're saying, oh, they get rid of dud words and they get a good word in. But I agree with you. Effect
yeah,
isn't
effect
that great
isn't that
either.
Great. But we do kind of now say that something snowballs, right? We don't even bother with effect.
We do it as a verb, which I prefer.
Yes.
So now, speaking of snowballs, Fletcher, all right. How old do you think the word snowball is?
Oh, wow.
We're asking you to name that century.
Okay, do I just have to guess, or do I get?
Oh, we'll
give you three
chances
for
okay,
you.
Okay,
we have 1622.
That's not a century, actually. It's a year.
Okay, yeah. It's named that year. You're right. Well, it's in the century.
Yeah, right. Okay.
The rebels took their way towards York. But their snowball did not gather as it went.
Took their way towards the Yorke.
But their snowball did not gather. I'm now going back to regular English as it went. Or
1400. Many of Bay City cast upon him many a snow aboles.
Very good, Cap. Okay. Or 1878. When a schoolboy makes a snowball, he squeezes a handful or two of light snow into a hard, compact lump. This is interesting. It's by T.H. Huxley, Physiography, telling us, I guess, how to make a snowball scientifically, but whatever.
Wow. I don't really believe any of those. I mean, I was going to go way back, you know, to like 1200. So I guess I'll say 1400, but that sentence you gave me sounds made up.
It's not.
Actually, you know, you're right, Fletcher, but I don't really think 1400 perhaps is even accurate. We have early indications that it was written down, like, and we have Frisian, which is the northern Dutch dialect, Schneeball. We have Middle Dutch, Schneeball, German Schneeball.
I like the German Schneeball.
I like Schneeball, too. So our guess is probably before the 1400s it came into English.
Well, I feel better about that then.
You're pretty good on that one. Okay, let's move on. Okay, when hell freezes over.
Yeah.
Was it used first by playwright Shakespeare in A Winter's Tale, by humorist Guy Wetmore Carroll in The Lieutenant Governor, or F. Scott Fitzgerald in his Letter to Friends?
Ooh, when was that middle one?
Humorist Guy Wetmore Carroll was 1903.
Oh, wow. I don't want to believe it's Shakespeare. Let's say Fitzgerald. Why not? Let's say Fitzgerald.
Well, you're almost
because
correct.
It's wrong. That's why.
No, but it's pretty close because, I mean, the first usage that we could find is Guy Wetmore Carroll in The Lieutenant Governor, 1903. And I'm going to recite, apparently someone wrote a review of this book on Goodreads, said, Principles, politics, personal interests, power, struggles, strikes, capitalists, and guess what wins? Honorable principles, of course, gave it one star. But here's the passage. And how long is this going on? Demanded their leader with a sneer. Talk, talk, talk. That's always the way, and nothing done after all. Well, that's about enough of that, and that's flat. You've been living on the Union, and I suppose you think you can go on living on it till hell freezes over. First usage.
Wow.
But F. Scott did often end his letters with yours till hell freezes over.
Oh, really? Oh, that's cute.
Moving on. In cold blood.
Oh, in cold blood.
You know what in cold blood means.
Yeah, with no real emotion.
Okay. So now where does it come from? From the medical belief in the past that blood literally got hot when upset. So being calm meant your blood stayed cold. Second, from slaughtering meats. The blood from a cow initially was hot, then cooled off, much like one's temper does over time. Three, a misquote from the old English, called bleu. I can't do that, Ross.
Blau.
Called blau. In cold blue. The blue referring to the color of the skin from woad, a blue dye used by the Britons.
That's tough. That's tough, especially since I know, like, the French have the term sang-froid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, but it's a similar thing. I mean, literally, it's the same thing. But I guess really just the idea that when your emotions get kicked up, your blood gets hot. So
yep.
Is that the right one?
You got it. It's the right one.
I thought that you were going to fall for Ross's called blow.
That was really stretching it. Okay, I think we're going to have to probably end the walking on thin ice.
Mm-hmm.
Which writer first came up with this idiom?
Mm.
Charles Dickens, Ralph Waldo Emerson, or William Shakespeare? Oh, I'm going to inject something here, which Kathy has heard of. We have a cousin who shall remain nameless from the Northwest.
From the PNW.
Who came to visit us in New Jersey, which as children, it was pretty cold in Jersey. We had a lot of ice and we go skating all the time, etc. Anyway, we were talking about walking on thin ice and, you know, falling into ice. She said, I don't see the problem. You fall in, you break the ice until it's hard, and you get out again. And I said, well, not quite. I actually insisted that it was easy, and everyone makes a big thing about it, and it's not a problem at all. But
wow. Wow.
Okay.
Well, this time it's Shakespeare.
I laugh. You're treading on thin ice there.
Yeah.
No, Ralph Waldo Emerson.
His line was good, though, Ralph's. In skating over thin ice, our safety is in our speed. He's right. He just gets sort of like a cartoon or something. Keep going fast.
Just go real fast.
Yeah.
Okay. Tip of the iceberg. Okay. We know what it means.
Yeah. All you really see is the little bit of the iceberg, and there's a whole lot actually underneath the water.
Okay. What major event probably spawned its usage? A tough one for you, Fletcher. Robert Peary's voyage to the North Pole in 1909. Wreck of the Titanic in 1912, or Sir Ernest Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, that sank, crushed by ice, in 1915.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess the first thing you think of is the Titanic, right?
That's the first thing you think of.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
No. I want to go with Shackleton. It's Shackleton. Okay, what is it? All right, what is it?
Titanic.
It's the Titanic. Yeah.
Do you want to know something? And this, we're going to get nailed for this not being scientific, but Shackleton is wrong for more than just one reason. Do you know also why it's wrong?
Kathy
and I looked it up.
Maybe there weren't actually icebergs or something. Maybe they're called something else.
Well, icebergs apparently, and this could be wrong, but from what we read, icebergs in the Antarctic are flat. They're not like those, you know, those mountain things that you have in the North Atlantic. They tend to be big and flat.
Oh, I didn't know that. Flows more or something? Like ice islands?
Yeah. I mean, they're still probably like much more below, but they're not like that, the mountain-like look that you sort of picture.
Yeah. Hmm. Wonder if that's true.
You know, I don't know if that's what we read. I'm not sure. I'm not a polar expert, so.
I don't even like thinking about icebergs. I don't like cold, so now I don't even like the thaw,
I'd love to go to Antarctica, actually, on those
ships. Are you kidding? It's cold and wet.
No, I'd love to. I've always wanted to go.
Oh, my God. You're not my brother again.
I don't think it's that wet, though, is it? It's not that wet. I mean, maybe it is now since everything's
melting. No, it's not
wet.
It's dry because it's so cold.
Well, isn't there, like...
Well, there's ocean
water around it.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Well, yeah, the ocean
true,
is wet. I mean, yeah.
Thank you.
Oceans
it's
tend to be
big,
wet.
Antarctica. Like, you don't have to be right by the ocean.
The interesting thing is actually, though, no one is exactly sure. The thought is it came from the Titanic because it was first used thereafter. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't a thing until after the Titanic.
Well,
so most people tend to
sense.
Think that's where it came from.
Yeah.
I also like, there are smaller pieces of ice in the ocean are called bergy bits, or growlers.
What, bergy? Like, oh, bergy, as in berg?
Yeah.
Why?
Bergy bits.
And this was sort of interesting, too. This is maybe an up-and-coming or a down-and-going new idiom. Bottom of the iceberg, referring to the unseen. It doesn't seem very common, but we found it in one case, someone talking about photons, which is one of those everyday conversations you have. Do photons travel? And someone said, the only way to get to the bottom of the iceberg in this case will be the impossible. Basically, I see the analogy to put the entire universe under a microscope and directly observe. But bottom of the iceberg, I thought was interesting.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's wonderful, don't you? Because the unseen, the huge thing that nobody, it's mm-hmm. like kind of like the elephant in the room, but not really. I mean, it's just like all that mush that, well, it's hard and large. You bump into it. Never mind. No, I don't know.
I think moving right along. Okay, this is going to be a fast one.
To have cold feet.
Yes.
What country did it come from? Italy? Germany? Or England? I have cold feet about this.
Ooh. I have cold feet. Italy. It's Italian.
No, it is German. It first appeared in an 1878 English translation of the German novel, which I've never read, Seed Time and Harvest, when a character leaves the poker table when his luck and his feet are cold.
Why did his feet get cold?
Well, because people had cold feet then because they didn't have central heating, I guess.
Yeah. It's Germany. Come on.
Yeah,
it's feet
cold
are cold. You're playing cards.
But the interesting thing was the idiom there, and it basically merged into something else because originally it sort of meant he wanted to keep his winnings. He didn't want to like bet anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it switched over to basically like, you know, anything basically. That's what apparently happened with the English. But there's some thought that it's been around a lot. It was around even earlier than that. Not mm-hmm. That's the first recorded usage, but we don't really
know. Well,
they
have like, there's, speaking of Italy, actually, there's an Italian phrase, which I'm going to, you know, butcher right now. Aver freddo ai piedi, to be cold in the feet. And that was in a play in 1605. But it didn't mean losing courage. That was when it was just like, I have no money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay.
But now we're going to do a really interesting segue. And Kathy found this out, which was just fascinating to me.
I love this. Since we're talking about cold feet, you make them warm, you put socks on.
Sure.
Okay. Now, talking about socks, we're going to change it. Can you figure out when the phrase put a sock in it came about, which is something Ross thinks about me often, I think.
That sounds real vaudevillian to me, put a sock in it.
I'm going to give you three choices. The 20s,
uh-huh.
Gangsta lingo. The 40s, fake Hollywood gangsta lingo.
Oh.
And the 1890s, you made a gramophone quiet. You shoved a sock over it.
I mean, my favorite one there is the fake Hollywood gangster lingo, but I guess let's back up to the 1890s then.
It was fascinating, though, because you literally would stuff a sock in that cone thing.
Horn. It was a horn.
Horn. Yeah, the horn. I'm sorry. Yeah, you put a horn in it. I thought that was really interesting.
Because you didn't have a volume control.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it's like a mute on a trumpet or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a mute. That's even better. You're right. It is. Anyway, I think it's a good time for us all to put a sock in it and end the show.
I beg your pardon, Ross.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.